And now, let's turn to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local officials, residents, and personalities providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, it's my great pleasure today to welcome into the studio another City of Palmer personality, Police Chief Lance Ketterle.
I'm a personality now, huh?
Well, yes. We've upgraded.
Okay.
We've upgraded. Yes. The city is becoming, you know, well. So, a series of topics, so many topics. Let's begin with something that, on the one hand, seems to be simple and mundane and all the rest of it. As summer has developed, more and more people are out and about. And people are out and about on their 2 feet. They're walking. They're running. Mm-hmm. They're also on 2 wheels. They're riding. Sometimes it's a 3-wheel bike. There are also 4-wheel skateboarders. And then there are 4-wheelers wandering around town. And I thought it would be helpful for listeners to get a sense of, okay, where can I do what?
Sure. Yeah, great question. And we'll get into the specifics of what you've got later on. But just for everybody who is listening, all that can be found in the City of Palmer Personnel Code and the various sections of it as well. So if there's a question that you have that's not answered today, that's what I would encourage you to do. Or just call the police department and give us a shout, and we'll be able to explain to you where things are allowed and where they're not.
Okay. So I'll start with an example I had walking, I think it was yesterday, day before, walking over here early in the morning, 6:30 a.m. It's pretty quiet out. There's maybe an occasional car, et cetera. So I'm walking on the sidewalk in downtown, and there's a person on a bicycle who comes riding down the sidewalk. So I looked and I said, he gave me warning because he was passing on the left and so on. And I thought, okay, well, what is the guideline? Because more and more people are riding bikes. How do you decide whether it's okay to ride your bike on a sidewalk?
So the guiding rule for that is that generally, and certainly in Palmer, bicycles are not allowed to be ridden on a sidewalk in a business district. And so that would include kind of the core area downtown here.
Okay.
Palmer defers back to state regulations on bicycles in Palmer Municipal Code regarding where they can and can't be ridden. And one of the places they're not supposed to be ridden is in a business district on a sidewalk. So they ask you not to have your bikes on a sidewalk downtown here.
Okay. Well, that seems pretty clear. Now, what about skateboards?
Skateboards, the fundamental guideline for those is they're not supposed to be ridden on city property, including the library and the library parking lot, and they're not supposed to be ridden on arterial streets. And an arterial street basically is, the general definition for that is an urban major road designed for heavy movement of traffic. So things like the Glen Highway, Arctic, Bogard, South Alaska, South Colony, those kinds of things. Those would be probably considered major arterial streets here in town. And you're not supposed to ride your skateboard on those streets in addition to city property. Of course, if there's private property where it's posted, then you need to adhere to those signs as well. And if you're on a sidewalk riding your skateboard, you need to do it in a manner such as it does not interfere with the flow of pedestrian traffic. And so people aren't having to dive out of the way to get out of the way of you and your deck.
Okay, what about this area downtown, the downtown business district sidewalks?
There's nothing that prohibits them, but again, they need to adhere to not interfering with pedestrian traffic downtown. And so that can be, especially on a busy day, say Colony Days or Friday Fling, when there's quite a bit of pedestrian traffic, that can be, it can make it almost impossible to ride your skateboard without interfering with that, because you just move faster and you don't have quite, well, some of these young people might have as much control over their skateboards as I do when I'm walking. But on the other hand, some people might not. So pedestrian traffic volume is going to dictate to a degree what's acceptable and what isn't.
Okay. In other cities around the country, we've noted the proliferation of scooters. Sometimes they're manually powered, kicked.
Sure.
And some of them are electric powered. And there are they're ridden all over the place. I have not seen very many scooters here in Palmer, but what would be the guidelines if I chose to have a little electric-powered scooter?
So in Palmer Municipal Code, if I'm recalling correctly, it refers back to skateboards and other similar devices, and certainly a human-powered scooter would fall under that type of category, like these little razors that the kids have with a set of handlebars. Now, if you put a motor on it, that is going to change a number of different things, both in where it could be ridden and potentially what consequences could be for making a mistake involving the scooter. And now, it might seem a little bit strange, but if you are driving a motorized vehicle of any kind and you're under the influence, you're subject to potential prosecution for violation of DUI laws, and it doesn't really matter where you're at. Now, I'm not saying that would happen, but it's something to be cognizant of because it's a motorized vehicle and you can't operate it while you're drunk. So where you could operate it could depend on what the particular path or trail you're on. If it's a no motorized vehicle thing, then that would be prohibited. Technically, bike lanes are for non-motorized vehicles, and so a motorized scooter, even if it's electric, you could run into some issues with that. Downtown on the sidewalks, it wouldn't be allowed because it's a motorized conveyance and not something like a skateboard or just a walk.
So this leads to an interesting question I have about noticing that there are gradations of complexity for motorization of one of these devices. And I say that because I've seen occasionally a wee tiny two-wheeled something that somebody has a little two-stroke engine on.
Yeah.
And they go going down, but it doesn't look like I have not noticed any registration or license plate or anything. They're an unlicensed vehicle or an unlicensed electric powered. Well,
yep.
Let's go to the more prevalent situation. Now, e-bikes don't have to have a license plate on them. Is that correct? And what happens with them?
So it doesn't need to have a license and a state registration if it's not going to be driven on the roads. So if it's an off-highway vehicle of any sort, then it might not need to be registered, and it probably won't have to have a license plate. And it sounds like, and I'm not familiar with the concept of e-bikes, but from what I'm gathering, it's an electric bicycle that helps you zip around from place to place, kind of a commuter thing that you might find in a large urban area. And if it's not designed for road traffic, then it probably wouldn't have to be registered. However, just about every place, and certainly Palmer is one of those, if you're going to operate your vehicle on the road, even if you're not supposed to be, you still have to adhere to the rules of the road. And so that would be treated the same way as any other type of motorized vehicle that's on any one of our streets in town. So, and four-wheelers are an example of that. Kind of segues into this. But if you're going to operate your four-wheeler in a place where you're not supposed to, in other words, on one of our city streets, four-wheeler operation isn't allowed. But if you do operate that four-wheeler on a city street, then A, you have to have a driver's license in order to do it. B, you have to adhere to the rules of the road, and you're subject to all the potential penalties that might come from violating any of the rules of the road while you're on your ATV, your four-wheeler, that you're not supposed to be on in the first place on any of our city streets. So,
okay, particularly with something like a four-wheeler that can achieve a pretty high speed.
Yeah, very much so.
And occasionally I have noted them on roads traveling along. The best suggestion then would be if someone notices that, they may want to report that.
There's an off-highway vehicle ordinance in the city of Palmer that describes the rules for that pretty clearly. And we certainly respond to OHV complaints on a fairly, I don't want to say a fairly regular basis, but a few times a year. Yeah.
Okay.
So
let's finish up with, of course, what's happening right now as we speak. The painting of sidewalks, so that now we've established what are apparently the proper places to for a pedestrian to cross from one side of the street to the other. And we've touched upon this in the past, but let's just wrap this up here by saying, okay, you're a pedestrian, you're going down the sidewalk, but we know that the nearest official, in the sense of painted crosswalk is way down three or four blocks. Mm-hmm. But there is a place where it appears that one would be able to cross because there's a corner leading to the other side. And again, this is kind of a judgment call. How does that work?
Well, so it's not necessarily a judgment call. There are certainly things that are called unmarked crosswalks, and those are found in profusion around town. Usually a good way to kind of spot those is if you're thinking about crossing the street, is there a ramp that leads you down to the street of some kind? And is there a ramp on the other side of the street where you might return from the road back up to the pavement? And those are disability accessibility ramps. And so that's a great indication that there's an unmarked crosswalk there. And usually, you said it correctly, very precisely correct, those are found at the corners.
Yep.
And so that's where we would like you to cross, is either in a marked crosswalk or, failing that, at an unmarked crosswalk at one of the corners, not just in the middle of the street. That would be considered jaywalking.
Jaywalking is an interesting term. Is it because jays have this tendency to walk wherever they want?
I have no earthly idea how that came up, but, you know, I could speculate.
Let's be specific here. Is there a jaywalking ordinance that says thou shalt not cross the street in the middle of wherever?
There is an ordinance that covers crossing streets. It's not specifically labeled a jaywalking ordinance, but in terms of pedestrian rules of the road or rules of crossing roads, yes, that's spelled out in Alaska statute.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Chief Ketterling, for taking the time to walk through that, because these seem like simple things, but I think we're increasingly, again, because it's summer, there are more people around, and there are more devices that people seem to be interested in using.
Very true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's switch to another topic that I know came up on Tuesday at the city council meeting, and this had to do with a proposed piece of legislation to the council members brought it forth, Sabrina Combs, Julie Berbrick. And essentially it was taking something that is in existence in code over in Wasilla and bringing it over here. And the sense I had is that, the simple summary, that a number of people living in various places in the city of Palmer have noted houses that they feel, whatever criteria they've used to decide, they've made some observations that seem to be places that have attracted police attention maybe a number of times, and by their observation seem to be involved perhaps in some kind of criminal activity, maybe drug activity, whatever. But wanted to find a way to address the issue, because they had seen over time their neighborhood be less, in their sense, safe. And so the proposal was brought forth to somehow deal with it by saying, if you have excessive numbers, if I think this is correct, excessive numbers of calls, somehow there would be action taken. I know the end result of that discussion, and both you, the city manager, and many others spoke to the issue, and the complexity of actually taking action when you have a suspected place of criminal activity. And if I summarize that somewhat correctly?
I think that's a fairly accurate summary of the meeting on Tuesday, yes.
Yeah, so the question then remains, I think no action was specifically taken to approve this at the time, but for listeners going forward who have concerns about houses that look like they have something strange happening, how is that going to be process so that the next time it comes before the council, there can be something that would be an action that might relieve people of their anxiety?
So I'm not quite sure I understand that question correctly, but I'll try to answer it anyway.
Okay. It's a complicated topic.
It kind of is. So this, like any other ordinance, is going to require a fair amount of research before I'm going to be comfortable working with the city manager together, and we put forth an ordinance to the council that we think is going to be defensible legally and able to be fairly enforced. And so those are the main things. And so we're going to have to do some legal research regarding where these types of ordinances have been in place in the past, how effective they have been in the past. In other words, do they solve the problem that we're trying to solve, or do they not? And are there constitutional protections that are in place that these ordinances might accidentally run afoul of? And the short answer is we're in early days in this right now, and we need to do some background research to see how we're going to proceed in terms of the wording on this. But the gist of it is, like you said, if the police are responding to some type of activity, and what type of activity is another one of those topics we need to research, because, you know, to me, it would seem that it would need to be some type of criminal activity. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this is, if they're responding to location A, B, or C more than one, two, or three, or however many times in a year, that the owner or the residents or the people at that property could be subject to some type of penalty, is the nuts and bolts of the ordinance. But how that's crafted, oh boy, that can take on a lot of different permutations. And so we'll have to look at it quite a bit to make sure it's done right.
Okay. So the sense I had was that there was kind of a suggestion that there would be a both an internal look from the administration of the city and police department, and certainly the attorney, but also involve in some way some of the people that have concerns.
Yeah, and I think that's important. This was kind of a citizen-initiated idea for Palmer, and so we're very interested in working with that particular group and hearing feedback from other folks that might have an opinion on something like this as to what they think the root problem is, because that's what we want to address. We want to fix the issue and not just write wording that doesn't address what the known problem is. And the best way to find out what the known problem is to talk to the people that are experiencing it. So,
okay.
Yeah, working with citizen groups in this case is something we definitely want to do.
All right. Well, this provides us a segue into another topic related. In the past, we have talked about the implications and the actualities of writing legislation at the state level, SB 91, mm-hmm. the particular example, where there was a change with SB 91 being written. And we talked about, on the local level, what kinds of things do we notice? What did you notice in policing that come after that and perhaps in some fashion could be tied to changes in SB 91? Now, I'm not going to go back and redo that, but I'm more interested in... We have now another bill, which has been described as repealing but significantly altering what was within the umbrella of SB 91. And it's just been passed by the legislature, and it's been sent to the governor, and it's indicated he'll sign it if he's not already just signed it. I guess it's early in the game. But what would you see as your sense of how this changes life for the Palmer Police Department?
So House Bill 49 is what we're talking about here, and I've had a chance to skim it. It's a lengthy bill. It's 93 pages long,
right,
as written. And so some of that will impact what the Palmer Police Department does on the front end to some degree, but much of it has to do with penalties, much of it has to do with sentencing, much of it has to do with probation and parole, those kinds of things. And so it's probably not going to affect police operations as much as some people might think. For example, with 91, which was... There's no other way to look at 91 other than it was a landscape-changing crime bill, and that's exactly what it was intended to be, and that's what it was. But it didn't necessarily change the way the Palmer Police Department did business all that much. What it did change to a significant degree was how district attorneys operated, how probation and parole was carried out, sentencing guidelines, how long people were staying in Matsu pretrial. But as far as police operations, for the most part, and I suspect this will continue if HB 49 passes, it was very much day-to-day operations as usual. You know, we were still arresting shoplifters. We were still arresting people for disorderly conduct. But what was different was how long they were staying incarcerated pre-SB 91. a disorderly conduct, if we had a person with a lot of history for disorderly conduct, they might stay in jail for the full 10 days for a Class B misdemeanor, whereas post 91, it was a maximum 24 hours. And so there was an effect based on that, in as much as we might be contacting this person much sooner. But the way the police actually did their jobs didn't change all that much. One could speculate they were doing their jobs a little bit more often with the same people.
Okay.
But the actual procedural changes were very, very minimal. And I suspect that'll be the case here as well with 49. If it passes, and I agree with you, it seems likely that it will, I suspect that the average citizen won't see much change in terms of the way the Palmer Police Department does things. And whether they will see a change on the back end as a result of sentencing changes or parole and probation changes, I don't know. That remains to be seen. One thing I do know is it does not appear to affect the statewide bail schedule, which is a pretty significant issue, which is going to continue to allow for own recognizance release for a lot of criminal activity. And so
That's interesting.
Yeah, and looking at the bill, and unless I missed it, and that's entirely possible, I'm not the authority on this, but I did not see that it changed the statewide bail schedule portion of it.
Okay, so we'll have to see how it plays out. Now, in the past, I've talked about, we have talked about the issue of the information that's reported about crime, criminal activity, and so on. And we referenced a change in the system that was going to be using an FBI expanded set of criteria that was going to be reported about crime. How has that progressed along?
It's moving forward. And so one of the things that we were pretty cognizant of when we went to a new records management system, ours had been a little bit outdated. We got away from FileMaker Pro and went to what's called ARMS, the Alaska Records Management System. Is this NIBRS compatible? In other words, can we do our NIBRS reporting the way we used to do our UCR reporting through this, or can we collect that data to report? And the answer is yes, happily. But the difference, so they're collecting things. One of the things they collect now is use of force.
Okay.
And it's not just any time an officer has to use pepper spray or, you know, or a taser. It's use of force that results in or was substantially likely to result in the death or serious physical injury of somebody. That's what the FBI is interested in NIBRS use of force reporting. And so we have to do that now monthly.
Okay.
And
well, in addition to the FBI being interested, I'm presuming that the added information will improve the picture of what is happening in the world. It's certainly a testimony for the legislature and various committees. That was a suggestion that the reason why this would be helpful is that when it came time to do the next revision or modification of the crime bill,
sure,
you'd have better information to be able to do that.
Yeah, FBI data is collected at a national level, obviously. Participation isn't mandatory, but you can lose some funding opportunities to the point where I think most agencies are, in fact, reporting the way the FBI asks them to. It's a voluntary but strongly recommended program, and Palmer's done it for decades. But yeah, it collects data on a national level. So in that context, it needs to be viewed for what it is, you know, broad strokes type of information on certain things. But it can give you some idea of what's happening on a national level. Now, it might not tell you the same thing, you know, if you can then break that data down and say, okay, well, Palmer reported, you know, these numbers for UCR in 2010. And in 2015, it changed to this. And in 2020, it's going to, change to this. Well, that can help us look at crime trends. We also keep our own statistics as well, simply because the data that the FBI collects for UCR or NIBRS isn't quite as detailed as we would prefer for those types of things. So, and we don't score things quite the same way in terms of what counts as a class one offense or a class two offense, or, you know, this is an assault, this is a burglary, this is a robbery, this is such and such. And so we dive a little deeper for crime reporting in the city than would be the FBI would be interested in. They wouldn't care, for example, you know, how many false alarms we have, you know, okay. in town, but we certainly do. So
Mike Malevsky here with Big Cabbage Radio. I've been speaking with Police Chief Lance Ketterling, covered a number of topics. Chief, what in the last minute or so that we have would you like to share with listeners as we're entering quickly, jumping into June and summer tomorrow?
Well, everybody, please be patient with the construction. It's going very well. We're not getting a lot of complaints from the flaggers, and I think everyone's doing a very, very good job in terms of traffic, and so that's good. We're very happy to see that, but it's going to be a summer full of it, so please be patient with that, and remember, when you're getting out to enjoy yourself this summer, do get enough rest so you're not fatigued behind the wheel, and enjoy the summer weather.
Okay. Well, thank you again. We'll look forward to your coming back in a few weeks.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mike.
Have a good day.
You've been listening to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local folks providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer, moderated by Mike Malevsky. This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.